Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, October 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, welcoming Dr. Jennifer Bayron to their breast care team, joining Dr. Patricia Ray Kennedy at the Saratoga Hospital Center for Breast Care on their Wilton campus, saratogahospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Duncan Savage, Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. He's here to discuss a variety of cancer-related topics, including targeted breast cancer treatment, HPV-related cancers in both men and women, oral head and neck cancers, and more. Be sure to get your calls in early. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Duncan Savage and your radiation oncology questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday. Joining us today is Dr. Duncan Savage, board certified by the American Board of Radiation Oncology and the American Board of Internal Medicine. Dr. Savage is the Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. He has been with St. Peter's for more than 30 years. He is here to talk to you about a variety of cancer-related topics, including targeted breast cancer treatment, HPV-related cancers in both men and women, and the importance of vaccines for that, oral, head, and neck cancers, and more. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number, though, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Duncan Savage, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Good. Thanks for having me here.
Let's start at the very beginning. And pardon me for going to square one on this, but we often talk about ionizing radiation. Most of us have no clue what it really is. So I wonder if you could explain what it is, how it occurs naturally, and then how it is that you use it.
Well, ionizing radiation is really present every place in the atmosphere. When we talk about ionizing radiation, we're talking about beams of energy that are able to create chemical reactions in molecules that in turn can cause damage to normal cells. And typically the target for the damage in normal cells is DNA. This ionizing radiation, certainly that's out there that we walk around with, is in such small quantity that doesn't cause any damage. But there were discoveries made probably about 150 years ago by some very pioneering scientists that found, I think just by mistake or by happenstance, that some of these X-rays at certain energies could cause regression of tumors. And so the way that ionizing radiation works is it creates damage to the normal DNA, but it also creates these free radicals. And that's a reaction that occurs in water molecules to create unstable molecules, which in turn cause damage to the DNA. And the way that radiation works, especially when we're working to try and kill cancer cells and spare normal cells, is that cancer cells are very bad at repairing the DNA damage from radiation, and normal cells are actually pretty good. So we take a look at that repair capabilities between normal cells and cancer cells, try to exploit that, and use radiation in that regard.
We're joined today by radiation oncologist Dr. Duncan Savage from St. Peter's, and our number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. You mentioned that the naturally occurring ionizing radiation is at very low levels. The initial experiments into this, or as you say, they were, some of them were quite by happenstance, were, I assume, fairly high power. Where are we now with targeted radiation oncology? Have we lowered that power threshold?
I think we've been able to do a much, much better job at identifying where the tumor is and creating a very sharp target between the area that we want to treat and the area that we want to avoid. And that's really been a tremendous amount of advance in technology. And I've been fortunate enough over the past 30 years really to be able to see that we're able to create a geographic spacing between what we want to treat and what we don't want to treat and really spare some of the normal tissues. And really, you want to get, you know, in general, for tumors, you want to get as high a dose of radiation as possible, because in general, higher dose of radiation, better chance you have of killing a cancer. And yet at the same time, you'd really need to identify geographically what areas you don't want to treat.
And how do you avoid going through that cancer into areas that you do not want to treat?
Well, there are really a variety of ways of doing that. One of the methods that's used very commonly is where the radiation beam will rotate around the patient's body. The radiation's always being targeted at the area of concern. And by having multiple entry points, you're able to create a very sharp gradient between what you want to treat and what you want to avoid.
It's very interesting. In RF technology, if you're a radio engineer or if you're running a radio station, mm-hmm. you talk about duty cycle and the amount of time that you could be near a transmitted signal mm-hmm. before your tissues heat up. Mm-hmm. Is duty cycle a thing that you guys worry about a lot?
We don't really use that term in radiation delivery. Typically the radiation that we give, there are two different ways of giving radiation. One is where you're lying down on a table and there's something called a linear accelerator that's producing very high energy X-rays directed at the tumor. Those are typically about 1,000 times more powerful than a standard chest X-ray or a dental X-ray. And at that energy, that's where we really see that difference in repair capabilities between normal cells and cancer cells. And then another way of giving radiation is brachytherapy, or where we put radioactive sources in an area that we're concerned about. Those radioactive sources are elements that contain radioactive materials that have a natural decay. And as part of their decay, they give off what we call gamma rays to the surrounding tissues.
And you place those in the body?
Yes.
What elements are we talking about?
The element that we use most commonly in our practice is an element called iridium-192. This is something that's manufactured, and it has some nice desirable capabilities. You know, originally it was Marie Curie who used radium, so that was what was done. But they have something called the half-life, which is how long that radioactivity lasts. The radioactivity of radium is in hundreds of years. So you don't want to be very difficult to manage from a radiation safety perspective. And obviously, these early pioneers really had no concept of some of these ideas about radiation safety and some of the long-term side effects of radiation as well.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us today, and we'll get to your calls momentarily. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You mentioned that you've been in this business 30 years or so. Does it ever blow your mind that looking back at the technology you started with and where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredible transformation in actual technology and delivery of radiation therapy, but also our understanding of how we treat patients. And, I think in the past it used to be, I kind of always think that it was kind of a, maybe 30 years ago, patients were coming down the pike, we'd always have the same kind of cookbook approach to them. But now understanding a lot of factors about someone's tumor, their age, some of the biological aspects of the tumor now, instead of just how big it is, we can do some testing to see how aggressive it is, if there are any genetic mutations. It allows us to really right-size the treatment for patients.
What things can you not treat with radiation oncology? What kinds of cancer are not really good for that?
Well, I'm a radiation oncologist. We can treat everything.
But, well said.
But there are certain things where radiation's not nearly as effective as other things. And so it's always walking that fine line between giving as much radiation as we can to control the tumor and yet at the same time not causing collateral damage that becomes prohibitive, because you never want the radiation side effects to be worse than the disease. And you always have to walk that fine line. So I think in terms of saying this disease we can't treat with radiation, you always have to look at that particular equation for the situation. And you always want to get that sweet spot to be able to have 100% cure with 0% side effects. But really, in actuality, there are very few tumors where that's actually the case.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us. The number is 800-348-2551. For those who are unfortunate enough to have cancer more than once or have recurrences, are there limits to, in other words, if you go through an extensive round of radiation treatments and then later on, a couple of years later, you get cancer again, is there a limit of the radiation that one person can take in treatment?
When we take a look at that, the first question we need to understand is if your recurrence is in an area where you've previously been treated, that becomes a lot more difficult to answer that question. Recently, for example, for women who have had breast cancer and have had radiation afterwards, we used to always say these patients can never receive radiation therapy to the breast again. But there's some work that's looking at to see whether there are some strategies to be used to give additional radiation therapy safely. And we're looking at that very, very judiciously. And in other places in the body, we are looking at re-irradiating and giving more radiation to that same site. If someone is having a tumor that pops up in a different place in the body, certainly that could be treated, especially if there's no interaction with radiation that's been delivered beforehand. So I don't think there's any total number of treatments or dose that is a limit in terms of that size. And you always have to take a look at the patient and always the risk-benefit of doing more radiation.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us. It's 800-348-2551 if you have a question. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back and check the email bag as well. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. We are joined today by Dr. Duncan Savage, who is the Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. The number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Fran writes from Wilton, how do you treat lymphoma, and can it be remediated or just treated and lived with?
Wow, that's a really good question. So I think the first thing with lymphoma, you have to ask a couple questions. There are many, many different subtypes of lymphoma. Some lymphomas are extremely aggressive and require treatment. Some are very slow growing and don't require treatment. And then also with most cancers, when you have a diagnosis of cancer, you need to establish what the extent of that cancer is. Is it just localized to one area or is it widespread? So you really need help from a pathologist on that, and you also need help with a imaging test to figure out whether the disease is confined. There are certainly has been a growing recognition that certain people that have low-grade lymphomas, which means a lymphoma that is not particularly aggressive underneath the microscope, sometimes those patients can be watched. And you also have to see whether a patient has any symptoms from the lymphoma. For example, if someone's thriving, doing well, no weight loss, eating well, no pain, and they have a low-grade lymphoma, that medical oncologist, who is a chemotherapy specialist, would be making that decision whether any therapy is warranted or not. And so that's something where definitely lymphoma can be is a situation, if it's a low-grade lymphoma, that it can be monitored.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us. Norman in Albany writes this email. How does radiation therapy in the mouth affect the long-term health of one's teeth?
Excellent question again. Are we only having excellent questions coming in today?
Oh, I don't filter too many of them, okay, so you may get a couple that you don't like. We'll see what happens.
So, you know, one of the hard things about radiation therapy is that there are definitely side effects going through the treatments, but also people can have long-term side effects from radiation therapy. And those side effects can occur months and years later. And always when designing radiation treatment plan, you always need to be mindful of that. So in the mouth, one of the problems with radiation therapy is that it can dry out the salivary tissue. Those are the saliva glands. And saliva is so important to your dental health. It kind of bathes your mouth. It creates a situation for your teeth to be healthy. And when that gets dried out, the teeth are at much higher risk of decay, and that's problematic. And also, the radiation can occasionally cause damage to the mandible and affect the blood supply of the mandible, which can also be very harmful to the teeth. So those are two long-term side effects from radiation to the mouth that can occur.
When you say it can cause damage to the mandible, are we talking about basically just a burn where the scar tissue there?
Well, actually, damage to the mandible can actually disintegrate a little bit because the mandible can be damaged in such a way that the blood supply to the mandible can be impacted, and so it doesn't get its blood supply, so that mandible kind of crumbles. You can have an infection in there, and you can actually what we call radionecrosis, which is death of the mandibular bone and the mandibular tissue from the radiation.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us. And, Doctor, one more email, and then we'll hit the phones, 800-348-2551. This email from Carol in Rosendale. And Carol writes, I am a 64-year-old woman. In 2003, I tested positive for HPV and had a benign polyp scrape from my cervix. In all subsequent yearly pap smears, the virus was not detected until 2021, after one of the most stressful years after I contracted COVID, received a vaccine, and if I were to be completely honest, I would have to say I overate, under-exercised, and overdrank alcohol. My doctor tested for the dangerous cancers associated with HPV. I was told none were present, and I should have a routine pap smear in a year. Any advice as to protocols or preventive strategies? I'm trying to reestablish healthy habits, and that's from Carol in Rosendale.
Well, Carol, healthy habits are, I think, just beginning to be appreciated more and more on how important that is for cancer prevention. So I think having a BMI as close to ideal, good diet, exercise, sleep, really, really important in terms of cancer prevention. And we really feel that if you've been tested not to have some of these more serious subtypes of HPV, I would continue to work with your provider to get the pap smears on a regular basis. And just vigilance on that particular issue.
And I know that you and I spoke briefly before the show started in the 1 minute we had when I wasn't dashing around about the importance of getting that vaccine for the HPV.
Yeah, there are a number of cancers where we can truly say this is the reason you have a cancer. And there are a number of cancers that are caused by HPV virus. We don't quite understand all the interactions of how one person who has HPV is entirely asymptomatic and never has any problems, whereas other people can develop some problems with HPV-related cancers in the future. But these cancers are typically administered to pre-adolescent teens, both boys and girls. And they're very, very helpful at reducing the development of HPV-related cancers in the future, including cervical cancer and certain head and neck cancers. And so a lot of parents are very reluctant for their kids to have these vaccines. And I would make the argument that anything that can prevent a difficult-to-treat cancer down the road that causes a lot of problems potentially 20, 30 years, 40 years down the road. If I was a parent with a young kid like that, I would really want to think twice before thinking I didn't want my kid to have that. So I'd really encourage parents to think that over.
Dr. Duncan Savage is here today. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones. Donna in Saratoga. Donna, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Savage. Thank you for being on. I am one of those parents who 30 years ago had walked through a medulloblastoma with my 6.5-year-old son. We are luckily 30 years post. However, we are experiencing many, many, many side effects. I have concerns about what the future holds. And I was wondering, are there any studies or any place you may direct me that I could get some literature so that I can be better aware of what we may have to face?
Well, thanks for calling. That's, once again, a very, very good question. These late effects, and especially we always worry about radiation administered to children and young adults, there could be a number of long-term side effects from treatment. And I think some of the larger cancer centers in Boston and in New York have what we call survivorship programs. So those are programs really designed in a pediatric oncology practice to monitor those patients down the road, to kind of get one step ahead of potential problems, to identify any long-term issues that might occur. And they do have specific protocols. I'm not a pediatric oncologist, but there are some areas that have areas of expertise on that that can give you a little bit of guidance for that. And you're absolutely right. You always want to get one or two steps ahead just so you're not surprised. And obviously, if there's a problem that could arise, you'd want to nip that in the bud.
Donna.
Yes. So you said survivorship programs at, where did you say, Boston?
Well, I would explore to see if the pediatric oncology programs at a large cancer center in Boston or New York might have a survivorship clinic where they really kind of specialize in sort of following patients who have had intensive treatment, as your son had for cancer when they were a child, to ensure that they're being followed and monitored for any kind of problems that could occur. And like you said, you want to be aware of what other issues to be on the lookout for.
Donna, thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. We go to Kay in Albany. Kay.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I had radiation in 2013 for an anal tumor. And in 2019, I started having extreme hip pain. And the little tattoo that they put on me during radiation was right on the right side of my hip, the right hip. And in 2020, September 2020, I had a total hip replacement. And it was completely baffling to my primary care physician why that happened so quickly. And the right hip was completely, basically gone. It had totally deteriorated. And it struck me that there was probably a correlation between the radiation that I had, you know, in 2013 and the hip replacement, because I'm, you know, I can't think of any other reason why that might have happened.
Yeah. One of the side effects of radiation therapy, and we talked about late side effects of radiation therapy when people get pelvic radiation therapy, is decrease in bone density. And so there might have been some decrease in bone density within that hip area, which led to a little bit more damage or perhaps some fractures or some damage. Tough to know, you know, whether there's arthritis anyplace else, but that'd be one of the things I'd be at least questioning, sort of take a look at. We really do try to monitor in women that we treat with pelvic radiation therapy. Bone density, make sure we're on top of that to make sure that anything needs to be done to increase that density we're addressing.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. She mentioned a tattoo. What does that mean?
Well, yeah. So what happens when we set someone up on a daily basis for treatment? We typically use some skin marks to align the lasers to get them set up. When we treat someone with radiation, we do a procedure called a simulation, is where we bring patients in for a CAT scan. We make a model of their body, actually a virtual model, a computer-based model, and we use tattoos because we want to get them set up in the right position. We don't want them rotated one way or the other by having these tattoos. We're able to kind of triangulate with the lasers to get them set up initially to where they need to be, and very often we'll do a quick CAT scan or some other imaging just to make sure of we're on target. And that's one of the big revolutions in radiation therapy. In the past, we used to have the tattoos and just turn the beam on, but now we actually take the extra step of doing some imaging to ensure that what we want to treat is within the target.
Does 3D modeling make that a better procedure with
Absolutely.
Better outcomes?
Absolutely. The 3D modeling allows us to do the modeling. We work on the modeling behind the scenes to see where, you know, for example, when we're treating someone's pelvis, to see where the bladder, the rectum is, how we can avoid that, and then treat the organs that we need to treat.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us today. He is the Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. Our number is 800-348-2551, and we go to Stephanie in North Bennington. Stephanie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My call is about what I've been told is called occult cancer, OCCULT. My brother was diagnosed with occult cancer about, I said, 2.5 years ago. He had throat cancer, and that was dealt with radiation and chemo, and then he was cleared. And then about a year ago, he had cancer in his sinus, which was also dealt with chemo, radiation, and surgery. So my question really is because all of us have been quite supportive of him, but we really don't like asking too many questions about prognosis. And they have claimed that the sinus cancer is the primary cancer. So I just have some questions about how they know that it's the primary cancer and maybe anything about what the prognosis is. He's been through at least 5 surgeries already and still getting surgeries for facial reconstruction. So So we're all hoping that that's coming to an end soon.
Yeah. So if I understand this correctly, Stephanie, the first cancer was in the throat, and then they felt there was a recurrence in the sinus area. Is that what it was? Was it the same cancer?
Well, they're claiming that the sinus was the primary, but the throat was not, is what we're being told.
Yeah. A little bit hard for me to answer that with having more details because, you know, typically, if someone is felt to have a throat cancer, you know, they would, ear, nose, and throat specialist would do a scope, take a look down there, do a biopsy, and establish that. And I think with imaging testing, for example, PET scans and CAT scans and scoping, they should be able to really identify where the primary was and have to have a little bit more details to be a little bit, give you a better knowledgeable answer on that.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for the call. And there, Dr. Savage, is the line we reach on Medical Monday very often where the doctor really can't diagnose over the phone. And so you just do the best you can. And we appreciate you being here very much. We'll grab one more call, then we'll take a break and we'll hit the email bag once again. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Duncan Savage, Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital, joins us. Jim is in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
With brachytherapy, how are the seeds removed once they're installed?
And Jim, are you talking about brachytherapy for prostate cancer? Well, there are a couple different ways of doing brachytherapy. One is that has typically been used for many years for prostate cancer is where seeds are placed within the prostate. They contain a radioactive element. Those seeds are there for the rest of the patient's life. But if you will, the radioactive portion of that seed wears out and gives its dose off. So those seeds are there permanently. There's another way of giving brachytherapy where we put a radioactive seed in a catheter, which is a hollowed-out tube. That seed would dwell for a period of time, but then it's removed after the treatment's delivered. So in the case of what we call permanent seed implantation, those seeds would be there forever for someone who's got prostate cancer. Most other types of cancer, that seed is only in there for a very short period of time during the duration of radiation therapy, and then it's retracted through that catheter.
Jim, thank you for the call. So there's no real danger in leaving those seeds in all for the rest of the life of the patient?
No, there's no long-term issues with that. The half-life and what we call radioactive decay of those seeds is typically about 60 days. So there'll still be, if you know, you actually put a Geiger counter next to that patient, you'd find some radioactivity, but at a certain point that is reduced. You know, we leave metal in patients all the time, whether it be staples or sutures, that type of thing. So that's the seeds themselves doesn't cause any major issues with that.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us on this Medical Monday. Dr. Savage is Chief of Radiation Oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. And our number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Medical Monday on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. Dr. Duncan Savage joins us on our program today. And a couple of emails here, doctor, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one is from Trish. Trish says, what is the prognosis for someone diagnosed as stage 3 with pancreatic cancer? It has not invaded the liver.
Kind of the mainstay of treatment for patients with pancreatic cancer, if possible, is to get the tumor removed. And if the tumor can be removed successfully, very often there's follow-up with radiation therapy and chemotherapy, usually always some type of chemotherapy. And those patients, you know, we consider that as whenever we see someone, we try to take a look at is, do we have a possibility of curing this patient or we don't have a possibility of curing that patient? And that patient we would treat with an aggressive approach to try and get them cured and do what we can with a combination of surgery, chemotherapy and radiation therapy, not necessarily in that order, to get them disease-free.
You had mentioned when we first started this program talking about ionizing radiation and X-rays being way up there in the spectrum.
Yep.
Are there any other radiations you use generally?
The main ones that we use are X-rays,
right.
And then we also use these radioactive elements, and as part of their decay from going from one element to another element, they give off gamma rays, and that's the definition of gamma rays. And those are the main things. There are other modalities that are used, not in the Capital District. There's something called proton therapy, and one of the advantages of proton therapy is that you're able to decide how far you want that beam to go and then stop giving off radiation therapy. So there's some really advantages of that as compared to other types of radiation.
So in other words, pursuant to that original question I had about how do you keep that beam from going mm-hmm. beyond the cancer mm-hmm. into things that are not sick, that's what proton,
right, right.
How does that work?
They're able to develop a beam of protons, and in a radiation oncology department, the brilliant people are the physicists behind the scenes that
right.
kind of figure this all out. And so they're able to, with this machine, decide, okay, this tumor is 6 centimeters from the surface of the skin, but the spinal cord is at 7 centimeters, so we want to give off all the radiation therapy by 6.8 centimeters. And they might aim beams in different directions. So there are certain situations where protons, I think, are clearly better than conventional radiation therapy, but there are certain situations where they've done clinical trials and really haven't shown superiority. So, you know, having better, a nicer picture or a nicer diagram of how the radiation is delivered might look nicer on paper, but it might not necessarily translate into a better outcome.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us. A couple of more quick emails, and then we'll go back to the phones. Jesse and Troy, hang in there if you can. You'll be next. 800-348-2551. Jane didn't have a question. Jane just wanted to give a huge shout-out to Dr. Savage and his team. And Jane writes, I was a patient recently dismissed, hopefully for good. Had to comment on Dr. Savage's kindness and thoroughness during my treatment. That's very nice from Jane.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jane.
All right, I hope you're not paying Jane off for this.
No, I'm not.
All right, this is from Mark, and then we'll go back to the phones. Mark says, please say something about the technicians who assist you. Do you use ordinary X-ray techs, or does someone have to get special training? If so, where can someone get that training around here?
The techs who deliver radiation therapy need special training. The closest program that we typically work with is at SUNY Upstate. This is a 4-year program. We also work with some of the schools in the Boston area. And this is extraordinarily precise training. These technologists really develop a very, very special bond with the patient. Very often patients might be coming in for 5 to 6 to 8 weeks, coming in for daily treatments. Those patients really understand what the patient is going through, act as support to the patients. They will bring them into the room, get them set up. They'll do all the imaging testing to make sure that they're lined up correctly. And these are very complex machines that deliver the radiation therapy and do so accurately. And always a kudos to the team that I work with. Radiation oncology and treatment with radiation is one of those things that you're really dependent upon the whole team working together, doing their job. The nurses, I work with wonderful nurses. I work with wonderful techs, wonderful physics people, wonderful people at the front desk. And I feel very, very proud of the team that I work with to deliver the care.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us today from St. Peter's Hospital. The number is 800-348-2551. Jesse is in Troy. Jesse, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Several years ago, my father-in-law had prostate cancer, and I remember a discussion at the time about how he could either opt to have it surgically removed or do radiation treatment. But that if he did the radiation treatment, that would preclude future surgery. So I was just sort of wondering, why that is. What physiological change does the radiation do that precludes surgery in the future?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One of the problems, as we talked about with radiation, there could be long-term side effects. And the prostate is in a very, very tough place in the body to do surgery on. It's behind the pubic bone, below the bladder, above the penis, in front of the rectum. And after you have radiation therapy, the tissue planes between those structures become very indistinct. So while there have been some studies taking a look at doing prostate surgery after radiation therapy, there's also a very big complication rate with non-healing. and problems with urinary control and a number of other issues. And it's felt that because of this complication rate and long-term problems after the combination of radiation therapy and subsequent surgery, that generally that's not something that we're really looking at as a great option.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's 800-348-2551. Dr. Duncan Savage joins us on this Medical Monday. Barbara is in Amherst. Barbara, you're on.
Hey, I just wanted the doctor to talk about pancreatic cancer and its causes.
Yeah, so pancreatic cancer is, I think, one of the fourth or fifth most common type of cancers in the U.S. We do feel that smoking is a risk factor for it. There's certain genetic factors that appear to be a risk factor for it as well. One of the problems with pancreatic cancer is that very often patients have symptoms that are kind of ill-defined symptoms for a period of time before they get diagnosed, maybe some kind of ill-defined abdominal pain, maybe a little bit of weight loss, maybe a little change in their bowel habit. And so very often it's discovered where it becomes difficult to take that out surgically. We talked about that an aggressive treatment for pancreatic cancer is very appropriate, and usually that entails a combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. But once again, surgery is a hugely important component in the successful treatment of pancreatic cancer. And just like we talked about beforehand, the prostate's in a tough place to take out surgically. The pancreas is in a very tough place to take out surgically. It's attached to some major blood vessels in the abdomen. It's attached to some of the structures in the intestine. And technically, it's a tough place to get out. And when you do pancreatic cancer surgery, you want to make sure you're getting out the whole tumor. That's really what you want to do. You don't want to leave behind 20% of the tumor. Are really looking to achieve what we call a complete resection. Complete resection means getting the whole tumor out with negative margins. And a margin is making sure
can
that... Go ahead.
Just a question. Do you so you know the general idea is never mess with the pancreas. Can you still do the Whipple?
Well, yeah, the Whipple. I'm not a surgeon, but the Whipple is done by some very competent hepatobiliary surgeons. That's removal of the pancreas and a portion of the intestine. And so I guess what I people do surgery all the time on the pancreas, but it is a difficult place to do surgery on. This is a not something that's an easy surgery.
Can I just ask one more question?
Sure,
so,
Barbara.
Different things cause the inflammation or problems with the pancreas. Is alcoholism one of them? And can you detect it with ultrasound?
So I think what you're talking about is pancreatitis. And
pancreatitis.
And so pancreatitis is a sort of a clinical diagnosis, but also it'd be supported by imaging, and also some blood tests can help you with that as well.
Okay, Barbara.
Right, and does that lead to a problem with pancreatic?
Yeah, pancreatitis and chronic pancreatitis is thought to be a risk factor for developing pancreatic cancer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. We appreciate the call. It's Medical Monday. And Dr. Duncan Savage joins us today. He's the chief of radiation oncology at St. Peter's Hospital. Is the long-term outcome, the long-term outlook for pancreatic cancer patients better now than it was 10 or 20 years ago?
I don't have that data in front of me, but I do think some of the numbers suggest that there's been some improvement. But it's still a very, very difficult cancer to treat.
You know, one of those cancers that I hear about, and I've only heard about it once in real life, and I know John Gotti had that, and it's one that in researching your topic, your specialty, I saw listed, and that was head and neck cancer. What is that, and why is it called that? I mean, there is brain cancer, there's lung cancer. Head and neck seems a rather general term.
It is indeed. So head and neck cancer is a catch-all term for cancers that begin in the head and neck region. So, for example, each sub-area in the head and neck area has a little bit of a different flavor to it. So, for example, larynx cancer is different than tongue cancer. For example, nasal cancer is different than oral cancer. So head and neck cancer is a little bit too much of a general term to try and make any generalizations about it. You really should subtype it and find out exactly what place in the head neck cancer, in the head neck region that arose. The Gottis didn't consult with me, so I wasn't sure. Yes.
Fair enough. Okay. Dr. Duncan Savage joins us today. We talked about X-rays. We talked about electrons. Do you ever use photons when you do this?
Yeah, thing? So I went to RPI, so I'm a little bit of a nerd, so forgive me on this.
Yeah.
So the way that the X-rays for radiation treatments are produced is through a machine called a linear accelerator. So what happens is that this machine will produce a stream of electrons, and that gets bombarded against a target, and the bombardment of those electrons to that metal target creates photons. Photons are really this type of energy, which indeed is used in the linear accelerator to create these chemical reactions, which in turn create these biological reactions down the road.
Very interesting. So when the photons are in there, are they a wave or are they a particle?
Well, that's
a little physicist humor.
Yes. So it depends on where you're at.
But all right, fair enough. All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Duncan Savage joins us from St. Peter's Hospital. You've been in this game a while. You've seen technological leaps. If you had to look into that crystal ball, where are we 10, 20, 30 years down the road?
I think there's going to be analysis of each individual's tumor, that they'll be able to do a genetic profile of that tumor to really understand what's the best treatment for that. Because I think there's sometimes we overtreat patients with cancer. Sometimes we undertreat. Sometimes patients have cancer that we don't recognize as much more serious than it actually is. And I think that kind of signature and imprint of what's going on genetically with that tumor will help us to right-size the treatment for patients. So, for example, you know, things have been recognized in patients with breast cancer back in 1990. Basically, every woman who was premenopausal with a tumor that was more than 1 centimeter, the recommendation was made for chemotherapy for that patient. But now we're really taking a look at sending that tumor out for a detailed genetic analysis. And that genetic analysis can kind of predict what the risk is of the disease coming back with or without chemotherapy. So even though chemotherapy might reduce the risk of the disease coming back from, let's say, 8% to 7%, that'd hardly be worthwhile doing the chemotherapy treatment. However, if we find that this cancer has a genetic profile that's unexpectedly a little bit more aggressive than we anticipated, then there might be a very real benefit from the chemo.
Interesting. So in your estimation, the real advances will be made in diagnosis, not so much treatments down the road?
I think diagnosis is going to be huge to right size, because the diagnosis will lead into the treatment. Because if you're finding out what those particular Achilles heels are of that tumor, what are the things you can exploit to cause more cell death and do that more safely, I think you're going to be able to use that information to, once again, what I call right size the treatment for a patient.
Dr. Duncan Savage joins us, and let's go back to the phones. Michelle in Niskayuna. Michelle, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer a couple of years ago after radiation and surgery. They said that she was in great shape. Recently, however, about a year since all of this, they have grown concern about increased calcium levels in her blood. And I'm wondering if that is usually indicative of reoccurring cancer, or if this might, and I heard a couple of the other calls earlier mentioning some long-term side effects, or if that might be something caused by the previous radiation.
Well, elevated calcium levels or hypercalcemia, there are lots of different reasons for that. So really a full evaluation needs to be done for that, for the whole checklist of why that can occur. One of the reasons you can have an elevated calcium level is if there is cancer recurrence. But I think a full evaluation needs to be done for all the different reasons why someone's calcium level's up. And a lot of those, you know, a lot of those reasons have nothing to do with cancer.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Michelle. We're joined today by Dr. Duncan Savage. In the waning moments, if you want to make a call, the number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. In these waning couple of moments of this program, and it went pretty fast, is there any wisdom you want to pass on about cancer or treatments or diagnosis that our listeners might benefit from?
One of the things I want to talk a little bit about is with the COVID-19 pandemic, people have not been getting the screen or have not been doing some of these routine health maintenance. So I think important to think about colonoscopy for colon cancer prevention. Remember, colonoscopy is kind of a great thing because it's not only diagnosis early cancer, but also precancerous lesions can be taken care of and removed. So I think that that's something to take a good look at. Smoking cessation, huge issue. Healthy diet, exercise. We really don't understand why exercise helps to reduce the risk of cancer. We don't know whether there's something about exercise that improves your immune system, but I think there's good data right now to suggest that that's a very helpful cancer reduction strategy. I think taking a look at identifiable factors, we looked at like HPV infection. I talked beforehand that this has been advocated for adolescents, but I think the CDC has recently included individuals up to 45 to get that HPV vaccine as well.
Why the 45 cutoff?
I think they felt that there were a lot of people that were at risk for developing these HPV-related cancers, hadn't been vaccinated, and there was still an opportunity to help reduce that risk.
Very interesting. You know, we only have 30 seconds left, and so I apologize for not bringing this up, but I've always been confused. HPV, it's a virus,
yes,
can lead to cancer.
Yes.
What other cancers are potentially caused by viruses?
Well, HIV is associated with increased risk of cancer as well, and certain different types of cancer, so that's another cancer. There's also a cancer called Epstein-Barr virus that can be associated with cancers as well.
Very interesting. Well, Dr. Duncan Savage, that's where we will have to leave it. Thank you for being here. Pretty quick, huh?
Very quick.
Not
very
too
quick.
Bad at all. Now back to your real job, and we appreciate you being here. Support Good. Comes from the bariatric program at Adirondack Health, Saranac Lake, offering weight loss surgery and lifestyle education. Better health, better lives, AdirondackHealth.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Duncan Savage of St. Peter's Hospital for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls and the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz screened the calls. And tomorrow on the program, we'll switch gears and talk weather with News 10 meteorologist Jill Swed. That's tomorrow. So when it's raining all day, you call Jill and you complain tomorrow at 2. We'll see you for that.